Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hi, listeners. It's Louisa here, head of podcasts at The Telegraph and producer of Mad World. During this episode, you'll hear Bryony and her guest Jo reference National Suicide Prevention Day. It was actually a few weeks ago, but we delayed releasing this episode after the death of the late Queen. But of course, it goes without saying that here on Mad World, every day is Suicide Prevention Day. And we still wanted to bring you this conversation because we think it's really important. We hope you take something from it.
Hi, Bryony here. Thank you for coming to listen to this extra one-off episode of Mad World to mark World Suicide Prevention Day. This episode does include conversations about suicide, so if you find that difficult, please be warned. But also, I just wanted to reference you back to a podcast we did in a previous series with Professor Rory O'Connor, who is an expert on suicide prevention, and it features loads of resources that can help you feel safe to talk about this topic.
Wait for a bit. And that's my key to those feelings that make you want to do something that's very hard to undo. Just wait for a bit. That's never going to be on an inspirational poster. Tattooists don't constantly get asked to put wait for a bit in Chinese characters. But it has been a key for me.
Joe Tricini is an actor, comedian and a champion magician. He is also frequently suicidal. Joe suffers from borderline personality disorder, and since speaking publicly about it, he's not shied away from talking about the darker sides of mental illness. Now he has written a book, 10 Things I Hate About Me, How to Stay Alive with a Brain That's Trying to Kill You, is out now, and I think it is truly groundbreaking. Joe, welcome to Mad World.
Hi, thank you. We'll be welcome about with wow, that we should call everywhere that.
Welcome to the Mad World.
That's it.
Welcome to the Mad World. I suspect your answer to the first question that I ask every guest is going to be one of the most frank that I've had. The question is, how are you really?
Awful.
Awful.
Awful. Are you awful? Are you not awful? Are you not awful?
I'm quite awful at the moment. I'm quite, yeah.
I don't ask that in a judgy way. It's just because I've got no frame of reference on how anybody could be anything other than awful.
I'm like full of anxiety, like back to school, September.
Blah, blah, blah.
I can't
that
speak.
That is a genuine thing. Yes, I know that feeling. That
I
am constantly anxious. Blah, 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 blah.
The world is, I don't know about you, but I feel like the world is constantly about to end.
Yes. Full stop. Yeah. Literally. Yeah. Yeah.
So when COVID happened, I was like, oh, now you see what it's all like, everybody. This is what my life has been like since I was 9 years old.
That's it. I remember I was living in Hackney and I was on the phone to a panto producer talking about the script. And I was near a Tesco's and I saw them queuing outside. And I said to Paul on the phone, like, people are queuing outside Tesco's. And I could hear him start to panic that was weird. But I just thought, like, the normal people must be having a nightmare. Because this is weird, and because I feel like this all the time.
Mm.
So for that first like couple of months, I was very fortunate in where I was, like sort of geographically, and it wasn't fun, but it was so beyond anything that I could ever. Given that I live in a reality that's consistently smashed in various different ways, to see that the one constant that was the real world. Become almost appeared fabricated to me was so scary I didn't feel it. And I feel it now, and I have a feeling that maybe literally have a feeling that I think I might be now experiencing my version of whatever normal people felt when it first happened.
Yeah,
because I've had to I've worked out that I have got to adjust my level of okayness. There was a certain line that I had arrived at very good, just before 2020, where I was like, oh, okay, I might not die. Let's go down this road. And then it all shifted. So I have a feeling that this is as okay as I get. Awful is as okay as I get, and that's all right.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't got another option. I just had to stop waiting for things to come back. But I say things to come back. I just had to keep waiting. I was waiting for my life to return. That's what I was doing. But my life doesn't return because, yes, things are open. Everything's open. All things are there. But I'm not the person that I was when they all shut and when they all left and all of these things. So I was waiting for something that can't come back.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had to adjust who I am. Not intentionally. I've not changed. I've just looked at all of my personal, emotional, professional dials and gone, OK, we just feel differently now.
Mm.
So I am living in that sort of space of trying to straddle exactly what you just said about the end of the world and the fact that even though I don't necessarily want to live in this world, I shouldn't pick when I die in it. So.
Mm-hmm. Listening to you, it's like reading the book, the thing that... You're very clear on this in the book, that in a lot of memoirs about mental health, there's a kind of a very neat narrative, a beginning, a middle, and end, and now I'm better, and the world is, and you can be better too. And this is going to make the book sound bleak, because it's not, because you're also very funny, and I kind of gulped it down in one greedy go, crying and laughing as I went. But you're very clear that your life with borderline personality disorder is sort of constant depression. It's like when you have TB, you have a cough, you know.
Yeah,
you always have it. But also, I mean, you talk about so many different things so eloquently and so frankly. You talk about the addiction, that you are an addict to cocaine and alcohol, and how you thought that when you put those things down your life would get better, and it was quite disorientating to learn that that wasn't the case.
Yeah. I was never prepared, end of sentence again, I was just never prepared for things.
Yeah.
But I think that from the first time that I went to a rehab, I didn't know what I was expecting, but I certainly wasn't expecting to put any effort in. They provide you with a problem and a solution. Mm-hmm. So whatever, they don't provide you with a problem, you bring your problem to them, and then they go, okay, great. So if you want to fix the drinking, the drugs, that, we have this. This is our system, and this is what you go and do. And I was incredibly, what's the word? I was really, really sceptical of it for such a long time. In that first go around the Priory, not least because the hit rate of successes coming out, when it's like 27% of people stay clean and sober on their first go. And I think that I really struggled. I always really struggled with the meetings, because I learned so much from them and from understanding that I just had a place in the world. But unfortunately, I still didn't feel like that place was in that room with those people.
In 12-step meetings.
Yes. Yeah. And the difficulty that I found at the time is the difficulty in finding any sort of way of staying alive that was not in entirely around something that I inherently struggled with, which was essentially being honest with large groups of people in a room. And because of that, I struggled for years. I really, really struggled to get clean and sober for years because I couldn't do the meetings. And the meetings are amazing. And not being able to enjoy or get anything out of meetings became a reason to kill myself. Because I was like, even that lot, even the people that have done all of the things that you have done are still going, nah, you're unfit here. And it took me a very long time to cope with that. And it's a shame because I never had any friends. And I could see people at meetings connecting with each other. And I just never did. I never, ever did. And my sort of awareness of that at that time is where I sort of realised maybe I've got more happening in me that I need to address in conjunction with the drink and the drugs. Because the drink and the drug solution is amazing and it works. But I still didn't find, like, I was like a bit of Meccano and Lego.
Yeah.
It was just like that. We've both got the same job, but just something about it just won't fit.
Yeah. You talk about how you always felt kind of other, and you always felt like, from in the book, you talk about
even from a very early age, you had an inability to fit in, even when you tried. So, for example, when you were told, you know, we're all going to wear football kit to school tomorrow, and you went and you were like, I like red, and you wear a Liverpool kit, and everyone else is wearing Chelsea. And even then, you're like, I don't fit in. And that sense has really kind of dogged you throughout your life. And I suppose alcohol and drugs were a way to kind of dampen and numb that down.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I know now I was not an unhappy child, and at the time I was not aware of anything other than what I was doing, because that's just that I had no frame of reference. And I think that I didn't know I was lonely, didn't know any of these things were a problem. And because I spent so much time on my own pretending that I was somewhere else, which I like on stage or whatever it was that I was doing, My body, my subconscious, everything about me is geared up, poor choice of words, to have a large amount of time between where I'm expected to be and where I've left, where I can't understand what anybody does in that time. Time between work starting and finishing for me is like the week between Christmas and New Year's, mm-hmm. every day. Is that it's like, what do I do with this time? Because I'm just here waiting to start.
How
again.
Do I sit by myself?
Yeah. What do we do? How do we do that? So I look at that. I do see a lot of parallels in that from when I was growing up. When I first went to therapy, the first thing he said, "What do you want from therapy?" I said, "Well, I don't want you to tell me that I had a shit childhood, because I didn't. Fucking did." And I only learned that now. And that's it. There's nothing I can do about that. But I do find it takes a weight off of me slightly.
Yeah.
When I do sort of try and self-reflect and look at how I am and how I've been, to go, actually, yeah, there's so much of this shit that is just reflective of what I did when I was eight.
Yeah. But also, I think when you're eight, your childhood is just your childhood. And there's very little reference point, as you said, for what is. So we can normalise quite a lot of dysfunction. And it takes fucking decades to get to the stage where you go, oh, hang on, maybe that wasn't okay. And that wasn't normal. And that's in itself quite a big thing, isn't it? Like learning in your 30s or your 40s that everything you thought you knew is absolute bollocks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's terrifying. Yeah, that like everything was complete bollocks. And I didn't help myself, because even though everything was bollocks, I then put another layer of bollocks on top of the bollocks. So it's like bollocks Jenga in my life.
So with like the alcohol and the drugs, you put the bollocks on.
Absolutely.
So I remember someone saying to me when I got sober, they said that what happens is you get so, like, I sort of assumed, I was like, well, when I get sober, everything will be better and all of my mental illness will disappear. It was obviously all caused by drinking and drugging. And then it didn't. And actually it got worse. And it was because I didn't have anything to numb out and I didn't have any alternative solution. But also, I think I was so busy, she said to me, you're so busy putting out the fires that you'd set that night, the night before or whatever, that you had no ability to get to any of the stuff underneath, if that makes sense.
Yes, that's a really lovely way of putting it. And I hadn't, that's a really lovely way of putting it, because it is that thing. Oh yeah, I was doing the worst thing I'd ever done every week.
Well, you say there was a point where there was like 3 months where every day you do another worst thing.
Yeah.
The thing that really comes through and really landed for me was where you say that we have this kind of quite binary view of addicts and of people they're just badly behaved and they don't know any better, or they're, you know, they were brought up. But you say you've always known the difference between good and bad and right and wrong, and yet you've still done the wrong things.
Yeah.
And that, as someone in recovery as well, that to me really summed up the problem of addiction, and the fact that you know it's wrong, as so often is made clear in the book, makes it 10 times worse. Like, it would almost be better if you didn't know it was
100%,
wrong.
100%. It would be so much better if I didn't. Because that was the thing, is because I was ignorant up until that first point that I went to a rehab, to all of my problems. And again, I thought I was getting away with it. I thought everything was fine. I was like an alcoholic Scarlet Pimpernel. You know, I was getting away with shit.
Yeah.
And then as soon as you provided another way, ignorance is now a choice, and that is still one of the hardest things. It's one of the hardest things to live with. It is, but it's also one of the hardest things to explain to somebody, anybody, with a level of honesty, how that feels. To be able to say, I know this is awful, and I'm still going to do it, which is a symptom. I'm not excusing mental health. It's not an excuse for bad behaviour, but it is an explanation. That's why that's what started to get harder when I stopped drinking and doing drugs, was the fact that I had no level of understanding. How am I this awful? Well, like, I just assumed, because everybody had said, they're your problems. So the fact that, not only just a little bit, that I did the worst shit when I was sober and I was clean. And then coupled with, you know, the other ways that my brain got worse in sort of within the 3 years that I was trying to stay alive sober, but without awareness.
Of what you had?
Of what I had, yeah. Because when I got diagnosed, my girlfriend at the time, she said, because I phoned, I was diagnosed. I remember phoning. I phoned her and I said, I've been to the psychiatrist and he said that I've got emotionally unstable personality disorder, and within 5 to 10 years with regular therapy, it might improve slightly. And that was not the good news for somebody that's not expecting it. It was for me. For me, that was like, oh, shit, it's a thing. Fucking great.
It's a relief.
Yeah. But at the time, personality disorders is such, again, now I know, it's such a difficult thing to bring to any relationship or room or just anywhere, because it's got the word personality disorder. The personality is, that's the thing that people see. The personality is the only thing that is available to a stranger or somebody that's prospective to be in a relationship with you. They judge whether or not they want you in their life because of your personality. So even before I've like opened with, hi, how are you? If they know I've got a personality disorder, they're going to think, well, if your personality is disordered, probably can't trust you, so back off. And I think that's the common sense. And so when, you know, we didn't talk about it initially in my relationship years ago, because it was like, well, let's not look too hard at that, because, you know, your personality is the thing that I fell in love with. So if I'm wrong about that, maybe I'm wrong about this. And like that was, that's a quote. And I was like, whoa. So I did. So I stopped. So we stopped and got through. And unfortunately, I learned just how awful my brain can be. Mm-hmm. And not just that, just how terrifying.
So you call your BPD Mick.
Yes.
Because you imagine him as like a big pair of Rolling Stones lips.
Yes, just shouting kill yourself all the time.
Yeah.
That's literally it.
I think this is quite... I call my sort of mental illness Jareth the Goblin King. It's David Bowie in Labyrinth,
yeah.
Because he's evil but quite enticing. And that to me sums up that it's believable. It's like, I know, I know that he's bad. Yeah. I know that he doesn't want the best for me. And yet I cannot stop like listening.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But that's the thing. All baddies are likable.
Mm.
That's the thing. You can't, like, if somebody makes you laugh, you trust them, or like you say, or if somebody is engaging in that manner, in that sort of.
Who's the guy? What's the film? American Psycho.
Yes.
Attractive.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. That's 100% it. You know, dreams. You know how dreams feel real. Like that's mental.
Mm.
But I dream awake.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't even like it would tell me things that weren't true. My life became, I began living a life that had three sections, which was the real world, the liminal space of leaving the real world, and a world that I started to believe was real. Because my girlfriend went on tour, my ex-girlfriend went on tour around the country. And then I essentially created, I had the real world there with my ex, and then a fake world where I was putting on a magic show,
mm-hmm.
which sounds so shit. But I started unknowingly creating a world that only existed in my head that I didn't tell anybody else about,
okay.
Where I was genuinely doing a show somewhere and I needed to work on it. Now, I lost about 6-7 months to this weird reality, and it shows how terrifyingly clever and manipulative the worst part of my brain is.
And during that time, I mean, you talk about how that was the worst thing you've ever done, which is that you stole large amounts of money from someone to pay for the magic equipment.
Yes.
And that's clearly something that still causes you. I could really feel the shame dripping off the pages when you wrote about that.
Yeah. Thank you for recognising that. all I can ever do is stop doing awful things. That's the first and only step I'll ever take is just stop being awful. And then life stops being a mistake and it's just a list of things to work out how I can survive with. There's context. This is why I put it in the book. I put it in the book because I'm the only person that knows about the worst thing I've ever done. And it's killing me. It is killing me. And you know, literally.
The secret.
The secret. But like all of them, secrets keep you sick, all that. You know, put it on a fridge magnet, all that sort of shit. That's the thing. But this thing, essentially what happened was a friend of mine, I took a photo of her bank card. And I then used it. And I'd sort of, again, in this weird reality where things weren't real, where I felt like things were real, it's something that I used to, I'd done growing up. It wasn't a new behaviour. It was something that I'd done with my mum that escalated as I got older. It was an awful thing to do. And because of the way that my head works, I forgot about it for about 6 months. I did that thing. And then I stopped thinking about it entirely. I knew it had happened. I knew it had happened, but there was a numbness to the reality, which was, and every now and then I'd just be somewhere and my brain, this is around the time when Mick woke up, my brain would just go, remember you've done something bad, by the way. I don't know, it's not, like, you've done it. You know it's not right, but just so you know. And then I'd forget about it again. And then eventually when the reality of it sort of came out and I'd done this awful, awful thing, one, people just couldn't believe it. People just could not believe that I would do something like that, because I'm me. And like, how can you do that? And my ex-girlfriend at the time said, you have to live with this now. You have to live with the fact that you have done this. And it was the first time I'd ever considered having to have a consequences. I'd never considered consequences because I just knew I was going to die soon. There is a reason that I put it in the book. I put it in the book because whatever happens in any day, good, bad, indifferent, my brain tells me about that thing that I did. I wish I hadn't done it. I wish I had not chosen to do that thing. But I know that there's a very real possibility that it's just me thinking about this now.
Right.
And with everything that is happening in the world, nobody wanted me to put this in the book, by the way.
Really?
Nope. Nobody. Of course not. Me putting this in a book is like, it's like a turkey trying to sell Christmas. I don't want to say there's a reason that I've not been talking about this online. Yeah. It's because I've filled up a book with all of the things that make my life difficult to live. But the reason that I've done it is because I don't want to die and I'm gonna. So if I'd put the worst thing I've ever done there, I'm now talking about it for the first time ever. You are there, nice lady, don't know you, but you know the thing. So Mick in my head is like, hang on, what, why? But they don't tell them the thing, because it'll get worse. And then he starts shouting, no, don't tell them. What are you going to do now, mate? It's in there for me so that somebody like you can ask me about it and I can tell you.
Yeah,
I tell you, I've actively spent like 10 years keeping these things secret.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to tell everybody and nobody asked. But I think that what's really, really important from the point of view of a book is that if anybody gets it, if anybody has what I've got, or they've got a family member that has what I got, where you just don't understand, I'm not saying that this explains it at all, but everybody has got a worst thing they've ever done.
Yeah.
I don't know what yours is. Anybody, I don't know, but you've got one. And everybody listening to this is now thinking of a thing. That thing might not be a big deal for me, but it is for them. I said the worst thing I've ever done in the book because we've all got one. And anybody like me is probably getting killed by it now.
Yeah.
The fact is, I can never do anything worse than what I did then. And I've tried to live with it as a secret. And I can't. So there's the worst thing that I've done. There's the worst thing I've ever done. Here is why. Again, the symptoms of BPD are not an individual thing. They're not rocking up into a classroom one at a time. It's one clump of awfulness. And there's just one me as a teacher stood in front of all of those awful bits. And the worst thing I've ever done is almost like a catalyst. It's the big thing. It's you know, it's the baddie at the end of Super Mario.
Mm-hmm. Bowser.
It's Bowser. There you go. Yeah, what a turtle. And my point is, especially with everything that's happening, I've just never got to do anything worse. I've got to stop judging myself on that day. It was awful, but I have to stop because I can't have a life on the other side of it unless I, in some fashion, deal with it. So the way that I'm dealing with the worst thing I've ever done is I'm telling everybody that I don't know. So then hopefully somebody else might be able to do the same thing and then also doesn't die.
How does it feel to you if I say to you that I read this book and I have read all of the things that you've done and I've read about the worst thing you've ever done and I still think you're really lovely?
Thank you.
Because I get the impression that is a hard... And when we talk about the worst things we've ever done, I wrote a book about getting sober and I talked about some of the worst things I've ever done. And it was like a relief. It was like I wanted also, there was a sense of that thing of like, well, if you know this now, you know who I am. Because I always feel like with the head I have, and I'm sure this is relatable to a lot of people listening, that it's like you say to me, oh, you're really cool, you really like, you know, we like what you've done, Brian, you've done all this campaigning, da 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 da. I'm like, but my head's like, yeah, but you don't know this bit. If they knew that, then it would be completely different. But I think when you put that in a book, it's like, well, you all know that now. And it takes it away and it's like, fuck off Mick, fuck off Jareth, fuck off whatever the name of your thing is. It's like, because you can't, once it's out there. But it's also a kind of, I think this book, to me, reading it, I felt like at points it took my breath away. You know, like you talk about wanting, you know, your brain constantly telling you that it wants to kill you. And, you know, I don't want to go into too many of the details of the ways in which you tried to kill yourself.
Yeah.
But then there were just the other things of like the everyday in the addiction where you were, I mean, you're fucking lucky to be alive.
Oh my God, yeah.
Like, I am so happy that you're sitting in this studio and you're alive.
Thank you.
Like, I am so, so glad. So, like, you were taking 8 grams of cocaine a night at one point.
Yeah, that's what it started off at, yeah.
Yeah, you actually had a heart attack.
Yeah, awful day.
Carried on doing it, right? You had a third of your gums eaten away by acute necrotizing gingivitis.
Ulcerative gingivitis,
yeah.
What a week.
That from rubbing cocaine on your gums?
Yes, but it turns out it wasn't cocaine. It turns out it was rat poison.
Of course.
There you go.
That's
why wouldn't it be?
Kids, that's why you don't do cocaine.
I've said that like it was all right in the first place. Yeah, it was rat poison. Yeah, it would have been fine if I'd just been doing the gear. Jesus. Don't do drugs. Thanks.
Pugs, not drugs.
Nice.
You know, you've ended up in court. You had your license taken away from you. And all of these things I'm thinking, I'm not listing them to go, look, Joe, look what a bad person you are. I'm listing them because it's like this is what we're humans, all of us are capable. And many of us are more capable of these things. And yet still, you know, we go back to that wrong behaviour.
Yes.
Like, that resonated with me so much. If I could tell you all of, you know, I don't have time to list all the wrong things I did while I was drinking and using drugs.
No, and I really appreciate that. And as a genuine question, has this worked in the sense of what you're saying is that you relate to that, and then that is, I can see, brought an emotion out of you.
Yeah.
And so... That me putting down these things,
yeah, really work. Like, really,
does it
there
work?
Were so many things that you admit to in the book that, you know, I think a lot of us battle with brains that tell us we're bad. And for me, that's been my whole life. Is like, I feel sometimes like I'm the worst person in the world. This is a podcast about you, not me. But I think what this book does is it, for me also, in that stage of the journey of recovery, is realising that actually we're all a bit of good and bad. We all do bad things and we all do good things, and that's okay. And so I would punish myself. So I know these bad things were bad, and yet I'd still continue to do them. And then I punish myself extra hard. And it's like, I read this and I just thought, oh, mate, give yourself a break.
Thank you. I mean, you just said there that it's not about me, it's about you, but it's about us. That's the point. It is about us. It doesn't matter what problems that we've got. We have a mutual problem, you know, with addiction. The word problem is doing quite a lot of legwork there.
A lot of heavy lifting.
Yeah. You know what? Exerting is not a strong point. But the fact is,
I used to say, oh, sometimes I've got a drink problem. Like, no, you're just a fucking alcoholic. Finally.
Yeah, can't stop. That's the problem.
I think the fact is it is us.
They're all of these things that I have, these cracks that I've got falling all over my brain, they are a thing. They're a thing. There are so many books everywhere that with titles and words that make no sense that are saying, this is the thing. This is the thing. And it's not like a cold reading sort of magic sort of thing. It's not. It's going, there have been enough people in the world to say they feel like this that we've learnt about, that we've written literal textbooks about it. Mm-hmm. But, and this is what I found really difficult, it's taken me really ages to work out, is nobody else has made the mistakes I've made. They're mine. So the way that these things have come out of me is entirely unique. Mm. So even though it's like my brain's found a loophole. Yeah, I know there's loads of info. Yeah, I know that the unstable moods, you're getting angry. Yeah, but nobody's beating themselves up in a casino and then tried to get steal money from them.
Yeah,
like sorry, it's a really specific reference with no context there. Sorry, but yes,
it's in the book.
Awful Day by the Book Tap.
Your brain finds a loophole still in the fact that you know there are other people like you, but it's like, yeah, but they haven't done that.
That's it. Yes. And that's the thing, is I have done awful shit.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for the awful shit was a thing. The thing was not a choice. It is my responsibility. It's my responsibility. I've spent so long sort of walking around hating everything because everybody hates me. Nobody hates me. There are a couple of people that don't like, this is what I've learned, nobody hates me. There are a couple of people that don't like me. I would certainly imagine, I'm sure it's putting it lightly for a few, but I am the only person that doesn't want me to be here. And I don't feel that, but I am not an idiot. And I would be an idiot to have been talking about this for as long as I have, to have been living through the addiction with my family, to get to this point and believe my head when it says that everybody would be better without you here. That's being an idiot. I've looked at enough people like you that think that I am not a twat. And the reason that I've started to be all right with it is, unfortunately, I disagree with you. I don't think that.
Mm.
But just because I don't believe it doesn't mean that you don't mean it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that.
Mm.
So that is essentially what gets me through my day, is the fact that I know whenever I leave a room, my brain is going to paint an angry face on yours. You weren't angry, but I will leave and I will immediately think, Bryony Gordon hates you. God, that went awful, didn't it? I can't remember what you said, but it was worse. And it will snowball. It will snowball. Mm. And it was, like Giles, in 3 days, I'll just be sitting having a Nando's and my brain will be like, Giles, the producer, he hates you. He hates you. He hates you. And you're like, hang on, I'm trying to eat chicken thighs. Yeah, leave me alone. But yeah. I expect all of these things now.
But I wanted to talk to you about the, you broached the kind of the suicidal, the kind of, what you explained so beautifully is, you know, we need to talk about suicide more. And what you really do is you talk about the mundanity, actually, of your suicidal thoughts. Like the kind of the norm, just the constant low level, kill yourself.
Yeah.
How might you kill yourself?
Yeah.
Because I think we think of suicidal thoughts as, I can't go on, that's it, you know, and you come to some sort of like, there's a moment and the, you know, and you go, right, that's, and it's not, it's so, you explain it all so well. And that also it's not just an absent, like wanting to not feel the way you feel. It's also that you actually think that your suicide would be a gift to everyone around you.
Mm. Yes, 100%, 100%. I know it's not true. I know it's not true. And again, it's always very important to say, I am not going to kill myself. If I was going to kill myself, I would have killed myself a long time ago. I'm not going to kill myself. But you in front of me and whoever is listening to us talk, that they are exclusively the reasons that I'm not going to kill myself. It's my responsibility. I've got to get to wherever I'm going now. But this is my... I tried everything else. So now, listen, I've not got to be... I don't open with it. I really don't. And I don't... I'm not defined by it. 100%, but I've got to talk about these things. I have to talk about them.
Mm.
And I have to talk about them in the same way that we talk about flu.
Mm.
Because that's what it is. That's what it is. It's beyond me why people. Because I mean, when you feel literal pain, if you cut your, if you whatever it is, you feel that. It's called a nervous system.
Mm.
That's what it's called. But there's still a stigma around having that that much of a problem. Every mental illness will turn into a physical one.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one. Just depends how long you leave it.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's devastating for people to not be able to get help or anything like that. But but this worker, you've got to put effort in.
Mm.
But with everything happening around us in the world now, what I'm going to try and take from whatever happens this week with that that book going out into the world, I'm not going to die. And I've done the kindest thing I can for me, which is, looks weird, sounds weird, but it's just telling everybody my worst bits. That's the kindest thing I could do.
Mm.
Because my worst bits are just a massive bat and I just keep on hitting myself with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the bat is getting bigger.
Yeah.
And every time I do it, I'm getting smaller and more tired and more dead.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's happening. I've been taught to exist in a world where we talk about problems. And I'm watching the entire world not talk about the problems. And I understand that it's difficult to understand where do we go, what do we do, but why is nobody saying anything?
Yeah.
Why is nobody saying anything? So essentially, I didn't understand the old world.
Yeah.
But I think I do understand this new one.
Yeah.
Which is not a good thing.
Yeah.
But I do know that if we're leaving the old world, going into whatever we're doing, the best thing I can do for me is take my worst bits and leave them there as well. You know?
Hmm.
Because I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know where we're going to be. I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah.
All I know is I'm here now.
And I'm glad you are.
I'm glad you're here. And I just, yeah. I'm glad that I'm here. Thank you for having me. Thank you for asking me to come on.
Thanks for coming on.
So
I've got more questions.
So. I don't know why I rounded it off. No, I'm not. I've got nowhere else to be. I'm immediately feeling bad. I'm immediately like, Brian, you think you're trying to get off now?
Don't. Don't. I want to tell you that you will not. Absolutely, you're wonderful. And I'm so grateful that you are here. That was something that I wanted to ask you there. So, yeah. So why aren't people talking about this stuff? You touch on this in the book. So you say, I often find myself out of tune with the general public discussion on mental health, where it seems it's okay to open up about mental health, but only the fluffy end of things. Go for a walk, take up a hobby, fine. I've tried that. I still want to kill myself. So we live in this weird place, don't we, where people are talking about their feelings and their true selves and they're being the authentic truth, whatever. But we're still not talking about this kind of stuff. About, you know, we talk about mental health, but actually we really need to be talking about mental illness.
Yeah.
You know, about the darkness.
Yeah.
And I think there's an assumption that we've sort of ticked the mental health box.
Yeah.
And everything's better. But it's not. We still have very few effective treatment plans. There's no effective treatment immediately available to people in this country or in any country that I really know of.
Yes.
And obviously people want a way to know how to feel better. That's really, really normal. And going for a walk does, you know, it can help people and it can shift a bit.
Good on you.
But what this does is it, you know, it goes really dark.
Yeah. 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 Because it is different. Again, like all of those things, I say it in the book, trying to fix my brain by writing a gratitude list is like trying to remove a tumour with a fucking spoon. It's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And with everything that we're doing at the moment, it's like the problem, whatever those world, you know, fixes that go for a jog, look at the nuts, have some fruit, whatever it is, or, you know, pick the phone up and talk to somebody. I hate the fact that the main sort of like thing to help people with mental health or illness is that you're not alone. Because like I am all the time. Like I'm constantly at home on my own. And I know that's a really literal way to look at it. But whenever I see shit like that, I'm like, yeah, but you're not on your own. And you know, when people say things, nice positive things, like, you know, when you get tweets and somebody like, hey, stop scrolling. I just wanted you to know that you are fantastic. You are worth it. And in my head is like, well, I'm not even going to finish the end of the sentence because you don't know me.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do understand and accept that there are so many people around the world that that is enough help for them. And that's okay. And that's the thing is, so it's not about stopping that. It's just, I wish that we just need something else as well, because not only is the problem getting worse, there was a much bigger problem tied to that stuff. Even when the international sort of conversation around mental health was changing, it's like there being a new hay fever. I get hay fever. It's like the best thing that I can treat my hay fever with is cetirizine. It's like there was just one day, there was just a massive new bit of hay fever that turns up, and it's 10 times worse. Mm-hmm. But nobody's looking for a new tablet for it because they've already got cetirizine. Well, I would just take the cetirizine because that's the hay fever tablet. And you're like, no, but my hay fever's, it's gotten really bad. I can't feel my skin. Mm. Oh, yeah, but no, we've got cetirizines there. Look, you get 3 for 1. That's fine. And unfortunately, when you are in a mental illness point of view, it's very, very difficult to explain yourself because you're constantly walking around underneath your symptoms. So it's really, really difficult. I wasn't able to do it. I wasn't able to do it for a really long time. Depends what day you catch me. Thankfully, you're lovely. Everybody here is lovely. And today's a day that I can speak. Mm. That is not every day. Mm. That is, if anything, I can't speak on the vast majority of them.
So what are the things you do? Like, what do you try and do to manage? Like, obviously, you don't drink, you don't take drugs. Do you take medication?
Yeah, I don't anymore.
Okay.
I don't anymore. I've suffered with insomnia, so very rarely do I go to doctor. My doctor's called Dr. Ron. He's lovely. I've got him on WhatsApp. You know you're ill when you've got your doctor's WhatsApp. So occasionally that, but I stopped. I was on so many antidepressants, antipsychotics. They're so important. They're as important as a plaster on a broken arm. Mm. You need these things. Some people need them forever. Some people try to come off them. Some people it doesn't help at all. I was so fucked up, and there was a level of fucked upness that I was achieving day on day when I was seeing my psychiatrist and stuff like that, particularly when I was clean and sober, where I was bringing him loads of new mental shit that I'd made up that I wasn't necessarily sure whether or not I'd made it up. I meant it. But then he'd give me another tablet, and then he'd up something, and he'd up that and up that. And for me, it got to a point where I knew I was going to kill myself. And, you know, I've been to that point 3 times. And I knew I was going to kill myself. So it's either kill myself or find something else to do. Mm-hmm. I found something else to do. Thankfully, I asked for help. And I managed to get off of the antipsychotics, antidepressants, which took me a long time. And I came down off of them purely so I could start again with a clean slate, you know, because again, with antidepressants, stuff like that, is you can't just stop doing it.
No.
You can't do it. No. If you think you're mental now,
try
stopping the meds immediately. So yep. Dangerous. But for me, I was just like, so I'm going to reset and then I'm going to try and find another tablet that works. And it took me nearly 2 months to come down of everything, sort of reducing the milligrams over a course of, you know, weeks. And I remember that I was like, when it came off, I was like, okay, great. So I'll just leave it for a couple of weeks and I'll see what happens. And in that couple of weeks, the thing that I had not experienced, which I had experienced but I didn't know about it, is dissociation. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about that. I did not know about dissociation being a thing. I was not aware of. And what I was speaking to you earlier about with when I took the money and with that sort of creating an alternative reality, that's dissociation. It is being unconnected to the things, people, everything around you. And I thought, oh, well, that's weird. I remember I was filming, I was in, like, I don't know, somewhere, a premiere in Real or something. I remember being like, oh, I felt like my brain was a room. And I felt like I was walking around. It's like I could hear the footsteps and like just around the things. And I was like, this is weird. And then I noticed that Mick turned up and there were a few doors, different things that he'd come out of. And I just thought, oh, well, hang on, I'll just see what this is. So then I'll bring back the, you know, and then I'll find a good antidepressant. And that's 4 years ago. I've never taken another one purely because I would never, ever recommend stopping medication. I would never recommend being ashamed of medication. Recommend was the wrong word to use then, but it's a thing. And for me, it's a thing that had a use up until a certain point. And then with a view to change, I stopped it. But essentially what I am doing now is I live in that symptom. That my main symptom, even though I feel like my main symptom is thinking about killing myself, it's not. My main symptom is dissociation.
Okay.
And the way that I try and view it is that dissociation is a good thing for me because I have a lot of insane thoughts, but the sanest thing about me is the fact that I know they are insane.
Yeah.
If I was not aware of the fact of the level of insanity my brain is capable of creating on a day-by-day basis, then I would die. Unfortunately, this is what I am. Hopefully one day I'll wake up and he doesn't come back. I do always hope for that. I have that. And some days, not many, I can only ever think of four, and I'm 34, so that, you know, that is not many days. But I always hope that one day he'll be gone. Mm-hmm. He might never go. But the worst thing I could do is pretend that I'm all right now. Because I'm not. History tells me that I'm not all right. And history tells me that even if I feel all right, at some point, I'm going to be not all right.
Mm-hmm.
Because of course I am. Because it's life and shit changes. That's it. Everything is going to change. It's not always going to change for the better. And I think as a race, we humans have been spoilt by stories and films because there's always a happy ending. Mm-hmm. So obviously everybody's just walking around going, at some point it's going to be good. It's going to be fine. Oh, shit. Not sure. Don't know. I don't know how it's going to be. I don't know how. But the only thing I can do in my life is control whether or not I leave it. That's the only thing I've got to do. It's really hard. It's really hard. Again, because I don't like me. That's not. It's a human thing to respond to something. You say something, particularly something negative about you. In the real world, society, you say, I hate myself. Other person goes, No, but you're brilliant. Yeah, I know you. That it's not an accident that you think that. Mm. It's there. I'm aware of that. But humans have to respond. Mm. So they have to either say that, no, you're nice, or provide some sort of fix for you. Mm-hmm. So you go, I hate myself. Oh, yeah, but you're really, really good. Have you thought about, going to do this artwork, do this drawing? And that doesn't achieve. It doesn't achieve anything at all.
So knowing other people think that you're brilliant doesn't change the way you view yourself.
No, and I need to be able to go up to people again, not straight away, but society, not even society, all relationships need to know that it's okay to say I don't like me.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a fact. It's not. It is not up for debate. I don't. The quicker that I can say that, and you can go, okay, and then we both move on, I have an opportunity to have a day. Just knowing the fact that, and it's really hard. It's really, really hard. And I'm very, very lucky because I really thought when I started talking about this stuff and started talking about suicide in the same tone as ordering chicken nuggets, I thought that it would catch on. But it hasn't.
Mm.
It hasn't caught on. And that's... I was shocked about that. But the fact is, this is what's keeping me alive now.
Mm. So that thing of just being able to exist, just accepting the fact that you hate yourself and just let me be.
Yes, because also, that's the... Because the thing is, without understanding that, everything else is awful. The happy days... Happy days, I use happy loosely, it's not, but like days, a better day for me is that I will, if I'm with my girlfriend or family, whatever it is, wherever I am, I will feel like it is a battle to show people my okayness.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that I spend more days awful than I do okay.
So it's exhausting.
Yeah, it's exhausting. But also when if I'm feeling happy, my brain, Mick, is like that. Don't tell anybody you're happy.
Yeah, shame.
No, yeah. Don't tell it. No. That's, well done you. Glad you're happy. Don't tell people. Because if you tell people, you know, when you get shit again, they won't believe you. They'll think you're lying.
Yeah.
So what I ended up doing was I was unhappy and unwell 80% of the time, but I was using that 20% to sort of keep myself in that okayness lie. Because I didn't want anybody to not believe me.
Mm.
But the people around me deserve my okay days as much as I do.
Mm.
They put a lot of love and care and support into me and my days. And even though I don't feel the things that they, you know, are doing, I do know that they are being sincere, and that the reason they put all of that help into my worst days is so I might be given the opportunity of better days.
Mm-hmm.
So, and really, other people are one of the main reasons that I'm here. So if I have a better day, that is quite literally a gift to them, because the only reason that they were with me on the bad ones is in the hope that they might be able to be with me on the good ones.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so cruel to deny yourself okay days.
Mm.
My friends and family have been around me long enough to know that I'm not well, and they are, and one positive okay-ish day, and I say okay-ish because I never feel great, I never feel good, I'm just here. That's not, there's nothing I can do about that. I'm just here, but I'm also here.
Mm.
And this is it.
That's fucking great that you're here.
This is it. And like, I don't love it. I don't, not the things, the difficulties. But the fact is, and this is it, because these are things that would be classed as attention-seeking things. Get it? Absolutely. They are attention-seeking things. I am seeking your attention to listen to my awful things and understand that there is... It's not in my best interest to say these things on paper, literally. But it is, because I just need to be able to move on. I deserve to be able to move on. You can't let go of something that you're not holding. You've got to pick it up. So I made a thing that I can pick up, and now you've got it. And I've forgotten that people are reading it.
Mm-hmm.
Double-edged sword. Because as soon as you came, that's the first thing you said to me, you've read your book, and that had not occurred to me. That, at no point.
Did I think,
Brian, I didn't think you would know. Of course not. Why would you? Like, it's just not on my radar. I wake up every day. I'm like a goldfish, but instead of 5 minutes, it's entire days.
Yeah.
Have you seen the film 50 First Dates?
Yeah.
I'm like that. I'm like Drew Barrymore on that. But instead of just a relationship, I forget everything awful I've done and treat all problems like they're news. Mm. And the fact that that you have read all of those things, and that you, for me, the fact that you related to them, that's enough for me. That's enough for me, because that book exists so I can at least try some sort of betterness.
Yeah, moving on.
Yes, if the book then helps somebody else that's done awful things in their life, or somebody that is a parent or a friend or a loved one, whatever it is, that doesn't understand how somebody could start doing that. I'm not saying you're going to agree with it. You know, I'm sure there are people that like me that might read the book and go, actually, fuck that, he's a wanker.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I agree. The main thing of that is I want to get rid of it, and hopefully people might be able to get rid of some of their shit as well.
Can I give it back to you for a moment and ask you...
As long as you take it back again at the end.
Okay. Can I ask you to... I wondered if there was a little bit that you could read to sort of end on almost. Now I need to find it.
Yeah.
Because it really stuck with me.
Yeah. I wanted to tell you I don't read. I own books that you have written, and I have not read any of them. I don't read any books. But I wrote in that first year that I was speaking about this, I wrote a thing about meetings and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you quote tweeted it, and you said, I forget the nice thing you said at the beginning, but you said, please read this because, as Joe says, meetings can be hope with legs and a face, which is a phrase that I had written, that I had done, and it was in really early sort of learning about Mick. And I saw that you'd said that, and I followed you. And in my head, I lodged, this is a lady that likes what you've done, has singled out a thing of what you've done,
mm-hmm.
and said, this is good and this helps.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
I've never forgotten it. So thank you.
Thank you. Really does help. Hope with legs and a face. I remember that so clearly, because I was very early on in my sobriety.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm going to give you a hug afterwards.
That's all right. Okay. That's fine. I like hugs. That's good. Just this bit here. That's it.
From there all the way to the end of the chat.
All the way to that bit there.
Is that all right?
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah. If someone is not quite in the place that it gets a bit awkward, we need to start sucking it up. Their life is worth more than our embarrassment. If you're reading this and you've ever felt like you want to kill yourself or even feeling like that now, wait for a bit. And that's my key to those feelings that make you want to do something that's very hard to undo. Just wait for a bit. That's never going to be on an inspirational poster. Tattooists don't constantly get asked to put wait for a bit in Chinese characters. But it has been a key for me. And even though I can tell you what's worked for me, every time I've felt suicidal, I've waited for a bit and the thoughts have died down a little, poor choice of words, and I haven't killed myself. We know that it can be the smallest things that prevent a suicide. The train that somebody planned to jump in front of was cancelled and it was too cold to wait for the next one, so they went home. And such are the little things that can save a life. But the problem is that such are the succession of mundane things that only need to happen once. Wait for a bit. While it might not stop you feeling that way again, it will give you an opportunity to find out about other feelings. If you wait for a bit, another feeling will come along. I'm not going to pretend it's going to be a good one straight away, but it will be a different one. And if you wait for a bit more, another one might come along. And if you wait for long enough, the likelihood of one of them being a better one does go up. Whereas if you do it, that's it. You won't be around to see the other nicer life that everyone will have without you in it. You won't get to enjoy not being you. You just won't be. The maths on that is 100% certain. There will never, ever be another feeling. Imagine all of the people who will ever read this sentence. None of us want you to do it. Every single time somebody gets to this part of the book, they don't want you to do it. We would rather have you in the world because you in the world means there's a chance of something else happening. I know it's hard to hold on when you feel hopeless, but try and remember the word hopeless doesn't actually mean no hope. It means less hope. You might have less hope than you had in the past, but you've only got no hope when you're dead, which you're not. So please, wait for a bit. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Joe Trittini. You're amazing. Even if you don't think so, I do.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.